Since I last saw you, which was, I don't remember when it was, but it was quite a while ago. And, but over the past 8 months, I have been exploring, and some of you follow my blog, and every week I add an additional Dharma post, my Dharma talk about, mostly about these veils. Could everybody be muted? I think that'll help people. Thank you. So it's been a really interesting exploration, and I'm going to just summarize it a bit and then take it a little bit into a specific direction that will bring something else in that Patty requested. So, as I mentioned then, we all use metaphors all the time in talking about our own spiritual journeys and investigations. Even the word journey is a metaphor. And I've noticed over the years how many times when students talk about their own inner life, it is full of metaphor obstacles, mountains, vast deserts, pits of despair, and struggles to overcome, so many struggles and so many obstacles. This is all very painful. And imagining ourselves as small figures in vast landscapes with seemingly insurmountable challenges really sets us up for failure and creates a sense of isolation. And these ideas take us away from being fully present in this moment, inhabiting this body with full sensory awareness, which is the only place we can functionally address whatever confusion and misery we may be experiencing. The visualization of veils with their woven threads of thought is a more accurate representation of brain activity. It also captures the way we categorize thoughts so we can have multiple veils about different subjects that we're either interested in or things we know about, and certainly about every person in our life and even every person, celebrities. We have a veil about, I don't know, Paul Newman. We have a veil about all these students with all these veils. Some of them are, ephemeral, and some of them are really quite present. And some of the most present ones are our own identity veils, what we think about ourselves, what we want other people to think about us. So we're madly weaving away at these veils of identity. And of course, other people have their own veils about us, and we can't weave on their veils. So it doesn't really work too well. But you can see how this really does apply. So as I said, I've been continuing to explore this metaphor, and I found it to be incredibly rich and liberating. And been exploring how to investigate, identify veils, investigate veils, learn how to eventually lighten the veils, how to learn to see through the veils, how to let them go. And then one time I led a dance of the seven veils, and not Salome, but where we did a wonderful guided meditation of letting go each of the veils of identity. And then when we donned them again, we donned much lighter versions, and then we learned to dance with the veils. So I've been doing sort of dance steps. How do we live with these veils? So there's so much richness here. It's incredible. A few weeks ago, I was sharing the Metta Sutta and found in the process a number of words that I hadn't really thought about before, that hint at the validity of veils as a worthwhile metaphor for sharing the Buddha's teachings. The sutta talks about, for example, breaking through to a state of peace. So you can see that throughness. Now, I don't think that works with the struggles and the obstacles and all of that, but it's really this sense of piercing a veil and breaking through and being able to see through it. To live unobstructed was another word. So again, the veil is something that's obstructing our view of what is there always. It's not far away. It's not on some distant horizon. That's so important to recognize that it's all just right here, right now. But where our attention goes, it goes on these journeys, on these threads that weave these veils, these threads of thought, saturated with emotion sometimes, that take us off into memories, into planning, into worries, into this subject, into that subject. So it's a really useful metaphor that I think that the Buddha would quite approve of. Another one, part of it was to not be taken with views. And that's really what these veils are. They're collections of views, what we think about that person, what we think about ourselves, what we think about that subject. Also within the veils, we have a veil on a subject that we know a lot about. The veil is full of a lot of facts that we happen to know. So, you know, there are things in the veil. It's not like we're trying to get rid of the veils because we're dancing with the veils. The veils are part of being alive, but we also have the opportunity to draw the veils and see and connect. And we do that in meditation often. We come to a, well, maybe not often, it depends, but come to a time when it's just all falls away and we have this sense of euphoric connection. Sometimes that happens. It doesn't happen all the time. But certainly on retreats, more and more, it tends to happen. But no goals, no achievements. But it is something that we can recognize. But we're not saying we want these veils gone and we don't want to have anything to do with them, because these are the veils of our lives. We just need to learn to dance with them and to notice when they become knotted and difficult and burdened, and how heavy they can become when we get entangled in them. So that's really been this incredibly rich exploration. And one of my students is a retired editor, and she just out of the blue the other day said, I really want to work on this. I really want to, you know, turn this into, you know, something. So we'll see what that something gets turned into maybe someday. So understanding the nature of veils, we can see that our ability to be present and compassionate with all that arises enables us to notice when our thoughts are tied up in knots. And instead of making an enemy of them or of ourselves for having them, we can follow the thought threads, seeing how one thread leads to another. We can go back in time and see, oh, I see. And we can take the time to do that investigation if there are these heavy knots that just keep getting us into trouble and getting in our way and causing us misery. That's really time well spent. Probably the thought began with a sensory experience. Something we saw, something we heard, maybe something we smelled that reminded us of something and sent our attention chasing down a thread of thought. Or perhaps it was something we did or we said, maybe some unwise action or speech that set off inner scolding, self-blame, or maybe defensiveness. When we are able to anchor our awareness and observe these knots of fear-based thought and emotion, we can identify them, can't we? We can identify them as greed, aversion, or delusion, the three poisons. The metaphor of poisons is kind of interesting, isn't it? It certainly feels like we drank the Kool-Aid following some directive that is far from our own wise intention. And if that metaphor is helpful for you, certainly make use of it. But what are we to do about these poisons? Keep our mouths shut? Be wary of eating or drinking whatever life presents us. Letting go of the word poison for me, but being fully aware of the seductive unskillfulness and deception of greed, aversion, and delusion, I find can help me more easily recognize them when they arise within my thoughts. We can even identify them in our bodies. So let's just do a little exercise. Just pause and close your eyes for a moment. And when I say the word greed, greed, notice where you feel it in the body. Just see if you feel it somewhere in the body. Maybe you notice like a little leaning in or a kind of hunger, maybe a little bit of grasping. We can talk about that later. Now, what about when I say aversion? Aversion, anger, hatred. How does that feel in the body? Where do you feel it? Aversion. Maybe you feel more of a pulling back or withholding or a hardening or clenching, a rising of residual anger, judgments, grudges, or perhaps a turning away in disgust, or maybe a readiness to fight. Let that one go. And now the word delusion, delusion. How does that feel? That's a whole different feeling, isn't it? Can you even pinpoint where you feel it, if you feel it? Maybe it's just an overall spaciness, kind of a foggy feeling, or perhaps there's defensiveness, an aversion to the word delusion, the suggestion that you could possibly be deluded. So feel free to open your eyes. So greed, aversion, and delusion are easily activated, aren't they? They aren't foreign to us. They are right here in our minds and hearts. And as we have seen, even in our muscle memory, even in our nervous system, is readily available. Our veils of thought and emotion are made heavy by them. And when we consciously investigate a tight knot, shining the light of compassionate awareness on that knot so that it loosens enough for us to see it from all angles. So we're just going, oh, I never thought about it that way. Oh. And having a sort of an I don't know, you know, a don't know mind is a good thing to have. Not getting all defensive about it, letting go of any sense of identity around it, then we become freer to investigate in a more interesting and curious way. So we're shining the light of compassionate awareness so that it loosens enough, so that the threads are revealed. And we can recognize the greed, aversion, and delusion at play and say, oh my, how human are we? And how fortunate are we to have cultivated this skill to be able to compassionately look more closely, not making an enemy of anything, but recognizing how dark and joyless is life when our thoughts are so tightly bound. How fortunate are we to be cultivating wise view, finding greater ease and insight into the nature of impermanence, the nature of interconnectedness, so that we are not isolated, no separate self, and the nature of how we suffer when we forget the universality of impermanence and interconnectedness in all life. The three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, dukkha. The Buddha's wisdom supports us, strengthens us, and enables us to look more closely and see more clearly. Shining the light of compassionate awareness loosens the knots and lightens the veil. But how do we do this investigation skillfully? We ask questions. We humans are always questioning everything. Google is based on our constant questions, our wanting to know. So we use that skill, but we need to choose the kinds of questions that lead to real discovery and help us release the knots rather than become further entangled. Not too long ago, I published my book, Asking In, Six Empowering Questions Only You Can Answer, as a guide to this very investigation. And if you don't already have it, it's available on Amazon, or you can order it through your favorite bookstore. And you can find out more about it on my website, stephanienoble.com. But, and this was what Patty asked me to do, because Patty likes this book, right, Patty? Yay! Anyway, so there are six questions in it. I'm just going to talk about the first few questions, because there are questions that I return to all the time. And the key thing is that we are often asking ourselves really toxic questions. So checking in with the kinds of questions we're already asking ourselves, like, who am I to do this? That's a really typical question I think most of us, or at least many of us, can relate to. I certainly can. How about, why me? Something happens. Why me? There's a question we get caught up in. Or something terrible happens, and maybe the first question we ask is, not, is everybody okay, but who's to blame here? Let's see what other kinds of toxic questions. Oh, here's one. Why am I so stupid? Why am I such an idiot? What is wrong with me? Those are pretty toxic questions. And yet they are questions that many of us are asking ourselves all the time. So finding a question that really is helpful, a question that would really make a difference in our lives, would be well worthwhile. Don't you agree? And the first question that I highly recommend in every situation, and it comes straight out of, as you will recognize, the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, is, what is my intention here? What is my intention here? So you find yourself talking, maybe you're with a friend or a partner, a child, someone, and suddenly you find yourself saying something, and you can tell this isn't going to end up well at all. And so you go, let me hold it. Yeah, kind of pull back a little bit here and just check in. What is my intention here? What is it that I expect to happen from this? Is going down this road going to bode well for this relationship? What's actually going on? So that's a really useful question. What is my intention here? And one of my students who's on a board said that she had a difficult board member, and she actually found that the board member would go off, you know, to sort of banging away at something. And she said, so What is your intention in saying that? And that, and the board member just stepped back and boom, he said, oh, huh. Never crossed his mind before. So it really is very useful. And it clearly is something that we don't tend to ask ourselves when we get into the habituated habit. So you can see that when we're in a relationship, we're caught up in that veil. We are traveling a thread that we have traveled many times. You always do this. You always say that. You know, you always leave the toilet seat up, or you don't turn off the lights, all those things, you know. And then if you can pause and say, what is my intention here? What is my intention here? Boy, that pulls me back right away. I think of my beloved husband, and so he left the lights on. What is my intention here? My intention is to have a strong and loving relationship. I don't care if the PG&E bill is 10 cents higher than it would have been. You know, it just doesn't matter. I don't catch myself all the time, I admit it. It's a habit of 52 years of married life to, you know, care about different things or to believe that I'm right and want to pursue something. But I'm finding this question, what is my intention here? To be a reset. It resets me. What is my intention here? So I share that one with you for sure. And I'd actually like to, at this point, open it up to a little discussion, and then we can bring it along to other questions as well. But I don't want to overload you, because I've already given you veils, and now this one question. And I'd like to just open it up for any, yeah. You're called User? That's an interesting name.
Sorry, I'm Deborah. I don't know. Whoops.
Now you're User and muted. Okay.
Okay.
There you are.
Well, thank you. And second of all, I love this because I'm trying to remember that more and more lately. What's my purpose? What's my motivation? What's my, and then I remembered, I don't know if I got this from Dharma or if I got this from Al-Anon, but it's wait, why am I talking? And I love it. It's W-A-I-T, wait, why am I talking? Which helps me remember, you know, my energy is limited and blah, blah, blah. Why am I talking? Wow. So I just love that you brought this up. It's just really something that I have a couple of relationships that are going through some transition now, and I want to express myself. And I'm thinking, what would be the outcome? And is it okay just to be expressing myself and speaking my truth and letting go of the outcome, because I'm kind of feeling it's either going to work out or it's not going to work out. And I'm okay either way in both of these situations. And so I'm trying to give myself courage and permission to just be honest and say what's going on for me. And so I'm trying to confirm with myself, why am I talking? Because I get to say my truth to these, you know, long-term closer situations. So thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Yeah, I appreciate that. Very wise. The only thing I would say as a little bit of caveat of why am I talking is just the history for women of being discounted and shut up. It's a little iffy to get, you know, why am I talking? Who am I? It could easily slip into that. Who am I to say
it? Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. You know that you're, that's not the place you are. And yeah, that you're more in the place of I'm right and I have a right to talk. And, you know, and it's a little, you know,
I don't know if I'm right. I'm I don't know if I'm right. It's just choosing, what do I want to do with the breaths and moments of my life?
Ah, oh, that's very wise. Yeah. What do I want to do? I love that question. Oh, good. This is recording. What do say it again? What do I do?
Well, it's like, you know,
what do I do with the breaths and moments of my life?
Yeah.
I love that.
How am I spending my energies and my time and my attention, beautiful, my efforts?
Beautiful, Deborah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else? Just unmute yourself and give a little wave. Somebody does. Alice.
Hey, hi, Stephanie. Alice. I didn't get your message about input.
Well, that's because I sent it to the wrong email, but then you were included. Never mind. Go on.
Anyway, so I didn't get to put my input, but I'm happy with what you're doing. And I just think that with intention, if the answer is that, you know, that it's kind is really important. If the answer that I'm getting is that I'm just trying to make myself be puffed up or whatever, I really have to examine all the different answers that come if I'm asking myself the question, what is my intention here?
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it's wholesome. That's all. That's my 2 cents.
Yeah, well, your two cents is worth more than 2 cents. Thank you, Alice. Yeah.
Thank you.
So you're bringing up an interesting thing. What is my intention here? And recognizing what it seems to be my intention if I keep going with this strain, like I'm trying to puff myself up, as you said, and then that reset of what's wise intention for me now. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing up that kind of little way we make a little twist to actually identify the intention that seems to be happening here, and then allowing to have that pause, that reset, and resetting that intention to our deeper intention, our inner wisdom. So thank you, Alice. It's great to see you and hear you. So Vita.
Thank you. So I think this is sort of the same thing. So what I've started doing with emailing is I don't send things right away.
Oh, so wise, so wise.
So it's like, I don't think I've ever used the word the thought of what is my intention, but it's, do I need to say this?
Mm.
Is it a benefit to anyone? I can't tell you how many emails I erase. But then sometimes when I do send it, I'm comfortable with it. But I like the word intention. I've never used that word around it. And I recently did something that was inappropriate. It wasn't terrible. It was just inappropriate. And I backstepped it, apologized, and had to for myself look at what my intention had been. What was I avoiding by doing it? Anyway, I like the word. It's a good word. Thank you very much.
It is a good word. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Vita. Yeah, emailing. One of my students was horrified to discover that she, because the other part of pausing before sending an email is also to check, are you sending it to the person you intended to send it to? One of my students called me horrified to discover that she had sent something that wasn't meant, you know, it wasn't gossipy, it wasn't mean, but it was just sent to the wrong person, and she was so upset. But I just said, yeah, we're human. Who hasn't done that? But that pause and checking on the intention. And I love that idea of just waiting to send an email, especially if you're a person who tends to kind of like to go on and on a bit. We all have friends who do email more than others, and maybe all that really doesn't need to be said. Maybe it's kindness not to overwhelm someone with, you know, everything we know about something, you know. But on the other hand, some people really do seriously appreciate getting an email. And it might be coming just at the right moment. So, you know, find a way to err on the side of something in the middle, like not editing oneself out of existence, but also maybe not overwhelming people. So probably varies from person to person. And also age has to do with it. Younger people don't want emails. They don't know what they are. Who else?
I'm sorry, what is the name of the book?
Oh. It's Asking In, Six Empowering Questions Only You Can Answer. Maybe we could put it up on the chat. But it's also on my website, so you can easily find it, stephanienoble.com. So, and there's a link on there to it. So. Yeah, Mary.
So when you talk about veils, and you have, remember the last time you talked about it, and so for me, I think one of the things I've been looking at a lot is wise view. Mm-hmm. And wise view is very much being able to recognize when you've got these little biases or things going on that are, that you, so that you're not, you know, where, you know, what's obstructing my view or what's informing my view, whether it's my attitude or my culture, my age, whatever it is. And it is, and so it's been interesting to watch my, when I'm looking at something, I mean, it's difficult to have wise action, wise intention, if I'm not even clear about what my view is and how my view is being informed, and to really take the time. And for me, a lot of times it's just like you said, do that pause, just take the time and really, you know, if I'm feeling patient, my view is one way. If I'm feeling hurried and rushed and impatient, it's another. It's just, you know, it's like, did I get enough sleep? Am I hungry? I mean, you know, just, it could just be any number of things. I mean, sometimes it's so funny. You think about it, how certain things can bother you, like a noise at one point. And then another time, no, it's just like, it just kind of rolls off your back. And it is interesting, like thinking about it as a thread as well. And I do like the fact that it is, because I know that these things aren't solid, that they're constantly changing, like the impermanence of my views. I mean, there's some that just kind of like, you know, they're habitual and then they reoccur and reoccur, but they are not. They're not solid. They can be there for a moment or whatever else is going on, and then they go. But I think that for me, one of the things I've been looking at is just trying to recognize what's, how much clarity do I actually have in a given moment, you know? And sometimes, you know, I need to sit and really, you know, do a little investigating and see and be curious about, you know, if I'm feeling tension or whatever it is that is I'm feeling as well, what's weighing them down?
Yeah.
So I can't move them aside, you know? So thank you. The metaphor is very useful as well for me. So thank you.
Good, good. Well, I appreciate that. And I think that exactly what you're saying is, I mean, what's already happening for you and the way you're seeing seems very tied into the idea of the veils that you're recognizing. And I really appreciated the permeableness. And I like that about the veils too. They're definitely very permeable. And so and when I read from the Metta Sutra about the not having views, the views are, you know, embedded in those threads of views. But wise view is when you part the veils and you recognize the, you know, impermanence in that amazing way. Oh, the leaves are falling off the trees, impermanence, we all die. And not in that real depressing way, you know, but that there is this incredible and cyclical nature to all of life, and it's all changing, and it's all interconnected. And it's just this, oh, you know, it's like when you're on a retreat and you just go, oh, whoo, wow. and then you start having these little threads and they get in little tangles, and being able to look at those threads. And something you said once, Patty, after a retreat really has stayed with me for decades now. You were on a retreat and you were walking along and you said, and you noticed a thought and you said, oh, you again, or something like that. You know, like recognizing the recurring nature of thoughts. And that's really important to recognize. Oh, yeah, I've been here before. Now my attention, not me, but my attention is following this thread, and it's going here and it's going there. And at this particular moment, I don't need to be doing that. I can be being in the felt sense of being alive and appreciate all that's arising in this moment, whether I'm eating something delicious or listening to a friend or whatever I'm doing, watching a sunset. It doesn't have to be a sunset. It can be any moment of any day, can be an amazing, magical moment if we're fully present to appreciate it. And when we forget about the nature of impermanence and we get it entangled in veils of thought of, oh no, you know, oh no, you know, why am I getting so wrinkled? I know you guys had Richard Shankman last week. I don't know how that was. I hope it was wonderful. But Richard was a teacher of ours for a while out at our Friday morning class. And the only thing that I remember, I swear to God, is that he just couldn't. It was just a moment in time, but it was the moment in time that he shared with us. And he kept going, age spots. And we kept going, Richard, get over it. And it was like, I don't know. It was just really funny. I'm sure he's gotten past that now. Anyway, and then the other funny thing is that next week you have Ashley Sharp, and she's also part of that sangha. So I feel like sandwiched in between two Friday morning at Spirit Rock sangha special people. Anyway, so enough about that. But thank you. Who else has something?
Hi. I have a subtext. I belong to another group, and my subtext is, what's my story? So I think you were talking about veils, but for me, it's the story I'm telling myself right now about what's going on, mm-hmm. why it's going on, mm-hmm. how it's going to come out. What's the next paragraph? What's the next sentence?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good segue, Jan, because not the next question in the book, but the third question in the book is what I'm telling myself true? So that, and of course, you know, we recognize, you know, where that comes from. But the second question actually is, you know, so what is my intention here? And then what am I afraid of? So recognizing that when we have unskillful intention, it's rooted in fear. So what am I afraid of? And then I'm afraid of this, that, and the other thing. I'm afraid that the sky's going to fall or that this is going to happen. And then that becomes the story question. is what I'm telling myself true? How do I know it's true? And that's that part of that investigation. So speak a little bit more to that, but I just wanted to tie it into the book.
Well, you know, because I want to make sense of what's going on. So I find myself often telling myself a story about the why of things. And I'm very future oriented. So if this, then that. Like, okay, I'll tell you this story about myself right now. My daughter was calling me, my daughter in Tasmania, every Saturday, which is her Sunday. And I haven't heard from her now for about a month. Mm-hmm. And so I was telling myself all kinds of stories about the why of it. And some of them weren't very happy stories. Today, I got a message from her that she's taking this massive 4-hour test. So I told myself another story, maybe true, maybe not, that she's been studying on her Sundays, my Saturdays, and that's why she's not calling me. Eventually, we'll clear it up, but I needed a story to make it all make sense. So people say, how's your daughter? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And I didn't think to say, I'll bet she's studying, because I didn't know until today she was taking this massive test. So anyway, that's my story.
It's a good one, because as a mother also, I you know, if I have a regular setup with my daughter and it changes, or for some reason it's not, I can tell myself something for only so long before I start getting anxious and wanting to know, you know, is she okay? Obviously, you know, and my daughter's only, you know, the other side of the county. She's not in Tasmania. So yeah. Thank you, Jan. Who else? Nancy or Marion or Corey or Sherry or anybody else?
Well, thank you. I can speak to that second question. What am I afraid of? I always find that when I'm the most unskillful, usually that's the root of it, or often that's the root of it, you know, and it's often in retrospect. So having the question to ask beforehand. Now, for me, it's always remembering to ask that question. Remembering, that's always the biggest piece, right? And typically, I appreciate what Mary said about, you know, all kinds of things can influence my mood and my reactivity versus my ability to have a skillful response. And so I still find that more often I discover this, that I was afraid after the fact. So I don't know if you have any thing to offer in terms of how do you even remember to ask these questions? Mm-hmm. I heard once that the translation that we use for mindfulness also means, or maybe more accurately, means remembering. I don't know if that's Pali or Sanskrit, I'm not sure.
Thank you, Corey. Well, I think our practice, our awareness practice, our meditation practice is the anchor. And as long as we're doing that practice, especially if we're doing it in a daily way. And of course, we haven't been able to do retreats, but that really made a big difference in my life, the ability to do retreats. And I get to go on a retreat again. I'm so excited. But cultivating that awareness through meditation is anchoring in and discovering that inner wisdom. So that when you're in meditation and you're setting wise intention in that state, you know what wise intention is. And it becomes the ballast that's also buoyant in a strange way, but it anchors you in that kind of knowing. And of course, you know, we're all dealing with hormonal imbalances and all kinds of other things going on. And we can sometimes get caught up like flotsam and jetsam and get tossed about on the seas of whatever. But if we keep returning to that inner wisdom that arises and let that still quiet voice be the one that we listen, we tune ourselves to more and more, then we have that connection to wise view, and also to keep taking advantage of opportunities to see the truth of, you know, anicca, anatta, and dukkha in life, and really recognize that and start seeing it more and more. That inner wisdom becomes stronger and stronger, and we're not feeling so small and tossed about. We're feeling the interconnection and that it's just expressing through us, if we allow it. But you know, we get so tight that we become seemingly impermeable. So a lot of light and awareness don't seem to get through to us. But if we can soften and release and be more receptive, then we open ourselves to the possibility of that inner wisdom saying, oh, now you're ready to listen. Now you're ready to listen. Well, thank you, Corey. Anyone else? We've got another probably 8 minutes or so. Yeah, Deborah.
I just want to suggest a lot of index cards pinned up around your living space. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, it works as long as you're home. Yeah, Mira. We're not?
Oops, sorry. Didn't mean to come on mute. Sorry.
That's okay. Okay, well, maybe I'll happen to be not in very good light for reading a book, but so the what is my intention here? Some of the things are, how can we reset our intention on the spot? That's kind of a good one. And the problem with should, accessing inner wisdom, and aligning with your wise intentions. And then at the end of every chapter, I give, it's a little book. It's a little, really a workbook. Because at the end of every chapter, there's a place for you to write notes. And so people go through it and they investigate. It's an invitation to really, for self-exploration. And so the what am I afraid of? If we found that our intention, as revealed in question one, was unwise and unskillful, then we can see how fear caused that intention, and in turn, the resulting words or actions that created unhappiness all around. I feel like I'm reading a story around bedtime. Rooted in fear, we may feel tense, stressed, depressed, or frantic, or perhaps we procrastinate, not knowing why we can't bring ourselves to do something we want to do. Fear can cause us to become violent, even if the violence is veiled and turned in on ourselves. When we feel out of control, asking ourselves the question, "What am I afraid of?" is an effective way to see the fear that has been causing us to make poor choices and miss out on joy. At first, our inner investigation will bring up stories about everything that the future could manifest. Given current causes and conditions, none of us knows what the future holds, but we can see from our own experience how reacting fearfully sets up a pattern of fear, ill will, and behavior we will later regret. Out of fear, we make enemies of everything. We spark fear in others, and they then react in ways that are unskillful, causing more fear in us and more justification for our fear. Fear creates its own proof, but that doesn't mean it's the truth. It only means that we are powerful and need to be aware of that. So, maybe there's, what time do we actually finish and do the metta? How much metta do we have to do, Rita?
I think there's about 5 or 6. It doesn't take very long.
Okay. All right. So how about if anybody, if that brought up any fear or anything else in anyone or any sense of recognition? Talking about fear. Does the word fear bring about any physical sensation? No. And which reminds me, I did a little exercise in the middle of that initial Dharma talk, and talking about the three poisons. And I'd like to hear if anybody had a physical response to the words greed and the words aversion and the words delusion. Just show of hands, did you feel physically the, yeah. Yeah, and if you want to speak to that, feel free to unmute yourself. If you notice one more than the other, Vita.
Well, it wasn't that I noticed, they were absolutely in different places of my body, which was really interesting. So, I mean, that's all. Each one was in a different place in my body.
That's so interesting, isn't it? So we're always giving ourselves this information. Like when we, you know, in meditation, relax and release tension, we're learning where in our body we hold tension and where that tension, how that tension holds on to thoughts and keeps us in thinking, thinking, thinking. And if we can relax and release the tension and we know where to go to find that tension, that's really important information. So this is in the same way, as Vita says, she noticed that aversion has a felt sense in the body. And if you feel like, do you want to name someplace you felt like something?
Let's see, the greed was in my abdomen. The second was aversion, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that was in my heart. And the third one is greed, aversion, and
illusion. Man, that's why you can't remember it.
And that was in my brain. It was absolutely in my head. I wrote it down. But and it fits. Somehow, and I could never explain why or how,
but you get
somehow, certainly the delusion fit. But yeah, absolutely. It was interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So now if any of you remember where you felt it in your body, or you want to do that exercise again on your own at some point, and you remember that I feel it in this part of my body, or it's a feeling that feels like this, then when that physical feeling comes up and you go, why am I feeling like this? You go, oh, I know that. That's greed. Or, oh, I know that. That's aversion. Or, oh, I know that. Our body gives us so much valuable information. If we can pay attention and recognize it. So thank you, Rita. Yeah. Anybody else have any noticing or experience of that? Yeah, Mary.
So Vita, you and I were pretty much registering exactly the same way. And one of the things I thought about aversion, because it was in the area, and aversion has kind of a heart closing quality to it.
A what quality?
Heart closing quality to it.
Oh, heart closing.
And that's why I feel like the tightness there. And delusion was just kind of like this swimmy feeling across my head. It was just really weird. But yeah, so yeah. So that was, I had to just laugh when you were saying it, because that's exactly right. It.
And what was interesting for me was that greed and aversion were very specific. The delusion was, like you said, much darker.
Yeah, that's so good.
Oh, that's great. All right. Well, thank you all so much.